Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is gambling author Peter Olson, and we'll be discussing his new fiction book called The Only Way to Play It. Peter Olson, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Happy to be here.
Before we get into the specifics of the book, your books are mostly about gambling. Are you a knowledgeable gambler? And if so, how'd you get started?
I like to think that I'm a knowledgeable gambler. I've been involved in the gambling world for a very long time. I first was exposed to it as a young child. I was 10 years old. And my father, who was a playwright, had a poker game with a bunch of his theater cronies. And I used to sit on his knee and play in that game. And, well, I didn't play it first, but eventually I recognized that he was not a very good player. And I had a sort of natural instinct for the game. And pretty soon I was playing with them. And winning, except when, the game would sometimes take place, with a playwright named Murray Siskel, who was one of the writers of Tootsie, actually. And Murray just hated the idea of a kid playing in the game. So when he showed up, I wasn't allowed to play. But the poker interest stuck with me. And by the time I got to college, I was playing in dorm room games and making my monthly spending money playing poker in college. And then I kept playing poker. Poker became I got involved in a poker game in New York when I moved back to New York. And that took place at a theater club, and so it was a bunch of theater people, and again I was doing well enough to sort of supplement my income. I was working as a freelance magazine writer at the time, and then in my 30s. I had moved to Chicago for a while, and I got involved in a relationship, and that relationship went sour, and I limped home to New York, and the magazine business was in a slump at that point, and I was broke and sort of down on the heels, and the opportunity, arose to go work at a bookmaking office, and I took it, and that was my education in sports gambling, and I did that for a little over a year until the office got busted, and I ended up along with the rest of the guys spending 36 hours in the Brooklyn House of Detention, and that was. That marked the end of my bookmaking career, but it did result in my first book, actual book, that I wrote about the experiences of that year. That book was called Confessions of an Ivy League Bookie, and it's being reissued this September 15th along with my novel. They're both coming out the same day, and it is retitled The Vig.
Curious
and
about
our listeners will hear a lot about The Vig probably in a month or so when we have Peter back on the show to talk about that.
Yeah, maybe this is a question better for next time we talk when we talk about that book, but my first reaction was, why would you change the title to The Vig? I thought the first title was actually much better.
Yeah, I mean, I will talk about that. The Vig was what I wanted to call it at the time it came out, and my publisher And you sound a lot like my publisher. They preferred the subtitle, which was Confessions of an Ivy League Bookie. So that became the title, and the VIG was used in the subtitle. And I just, you know, reissuing the book now, 25 years later, just seemed like a good opportunity to do what I had always wanted to do. So it may be a mistake. My wife thinks it's a mistake, but I'm kind of stubborn that way.
During the talking previously, you mentioned the Mayfair Club. How much did you play there, or were you just an observer?
I played there a lot. In fact, that pretty much coincided with the time that I started working at the bookie office, because I had a lot of disposable income at the time, and I started going to the Mayfair, and that was back when the Mayfair was in its, you know, in its heyday. So I got to know Eric Seidel and Howard Lederer and Jay Heimowitz and
Robbie Sankiewicz and Roger Lowe and probably Billy Horan and probably Jason Lester and maybe Dennis Waterman, if you were there when he was there.
No, I didn't know Dennis. Nolly Francisco was there. I mean, there were, you know, it was sort of an all-star crew. And I didn't, oddly enough, I mean, given the fact that I ended up doing a book on Stu Unger, I did not meet Stu Unger at that time. I had met him back in the late 80s. I went to Vegas to do a piece for the Village Voice on the Super Bowl of poker, and Stewie won the tournament. And so I did an interview with him at that time, and that was the first time I met Stewie.
The Super Bowl, was that the Amarillo Slims tournament?
That was Amarillo Slims tournament, exactly.
Yeah. Boy, that's a blast from the past.
Yeah, hanging on my wall is a picture of me and Slim at the tournament where they had a media game that I played in, and Slim sat in to deal a few hands. And so I have a picture in my office of Slim dealing a hand of seven card stud to me.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right. So let's talk about the book.
Yes.
Now the book takes place between 2005, 2012, approximately. Is the New York poker scene today similar to the way it was in that spot of time?
Well, obviously now with COVID, there's a very limited scene, although, you know, poker players are amazing. I mean, I myself would not play in a live poker game until there's a vaccine. But there are guys who've started up underground games that are going on right now. But I would say that the poker scene in New York is very different and has been different since 2011. Before 2011, there were a lot of big rooms in town with clubs that had up to 10 tables, and it started getting very public. There were Alex Rodriguez, the Yankees was playing, various other celebrities, and it was showing up in the tabloids, in the Daily News, in the New York Post, and it started getting too much publicity, and that drew both police attention and criminal attention, and so the clubs started getting robbed with some frequency, and then in 2011. A guy I knew, Frank DeSena, was in one of the clubs, a club called City Limits, that had about 10 or 11 tables. And the game was held up, and Frank was, shot and killed. And that was really, I mean, you know, that was terrible in many ways, but it was also, for months, the cops shut down every club in the city, and the games just went deeper underground. And when they reemerged, because, you know, these poker players and game runners are like cockroaches, you can't kill them. When they reemerged, they were much smaller. They were one and two table clubs. And that's pretty much the way it's stayed ever since. So there has been a lively underground scene, but it's very different than it used to be. And frankly, it's gotten, the games have gotten, you know, tougher because you used to have, feeder games that would, you know, sort of keep players, moving up to games that they weren't equipped to play. And so those games always had, you know, new money coming in. And now you see the same faces over and over.
I would have thought after Black Friday, just the demand would have, you know, made things grow. But also, I guess people, it's not that far to Atlantic City. Or, I mean, if you go just over the border to New Jersey, you can play online legally, right? So...
You can. But I mean, still, you know, people, you know, convenience trumps all.
Sure.
And if you can, you know, I used to, there were clubs in my neighborhood that I could walk to and be there in 5 minutes. So, you know, that's a huge inducement to play in a place. And I was actually playing in a club, over just a few blocks from my house. That got raided. This is going back, I guess about 2 years ago, and maybe not even that long. Man, they, you know, that was the first time I was ever in a club when it was raided by the cops, and they came in full assault gear, you know, with guns and shields, and it turned out that club, that the guys who were running it, who were not the brightest bulbs, were also dealing heroin. And so the cops had basically followed them from the place in the East Village where they were dealing heroin, had followed them to the poker club. And that's how they discovered the poker club. And the reason they came in with assault gear is because, these guys, had a reputation for, you know, having weapons on them. None of which I knew. If I had known any of that, I wouldn't have been playing there.
The book also involves the art world where paintings are sold in galleries and stuff like that. Do you have a personal experience with that, or is that all research and fiction?
Well, it's a combination. I do have experience with it. I mean, I grew up in a very artistic family. I have there are a couple of painters in my family. I spent my summers growing up in Provincetown, Massachusetts, and I was surrounded by writers and artists. Later on, when I became a writer myself, I occasionally would go to art colonies and do residencies there. So places like the Virginia Center for the Arts and Ragdale outside of Chicago. And I met lots of visual artists at those places and was fascinated by their process and also because they would invite me in for studio visits. And so I could see the work that they were doing and ask them. And I was very interested in what they were doing because it felt, very different from what I was doing. I think most writers are fairly tortured, and it just looked so much more enjoyable to make, a painting than it is to write something. And unfortunately, I don't seem to have inherited any of that particular artistic talent from my from the people in my family who have it. I then started collecting art. I like having art in my home. And so I have a fairly extensive art collection now. And I also became friendly with one gallery owner in particular, and got a hell of an education from him about how the art works. I found that fascinating, not only how the gallery scene works, but the auction houses, which I ended up using in my novel. And then of course to fill it out, I did do a lot of research and read as much as I could about the art world.
We mentioned the Mayfair Club earlier. For me, I mean, there were other games played there, but primarily that was a backgammon club insofar as my life goes. The poker players that you have in your book, the degenerates, could easily have been regulars at the Mayfair rather than some of these clubs. I definitely recognized the type. Were your players caricatures of actual people you met or some kind of composites?
I would say mostly they're composites. There are a couple of them that are pretty closely drawn and might be recognizable to people who know them, but for the most part, they're composites, several people combined, just to make, you know, a interesting, colorful character.
Yeah, I found the characters to be incredibly true, including the main character, who often I find poker players sort of do not understand bankroll requirements, which is, you know, something we talk about fairly often on this show. And many poker players who may be winning poker players go broke at times because of that, because they don't understand how to manage a bankroll and, you know, end up driving a cab for months at a time to get back into action. So that just rang so true to me, but very depressing.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, it's interesting. And I forgot to mention this when in the question about the art world. The main character in the novel, the protagonist, was inspired by a good, probably my best friend in the poker world. Who I met back in the late 90s. And he was a painter who was supporting his art habit by playing poker. And he was probably the best poker player in the city. He was an incredible player. And he then got married and had, in pretty rapid succession, a couple of kids. And suddenly his relationship to the game, his ability to play the game, was compromised. The pressure of supporting a family had such a deleterious effect on him that, I watched it and was both fascinated and horrified. To see what was happening to him. And, you know, he doesn't play poker anymore. I mean, he didn't have the right temperament to be able to take that added pressure.
Well, also the general level of ability has risen substantially over the last 20 years. People have just gotten much, much better. The average player.
It, very, very true. It's kind of humbling because when I started playing, which was back in the 80s, there just weren't that many good players, and especially at Texas Hold'em. And especially at Texas Hold'em, played No Limit. There just weren't a lot of games going. So, you know, players were really on a learning curve. And the internet changed all of that, and accelerated, the rate at which people learned. And then, you know, back in those days, it was all because it took many years to learn how to play the game. The best players were older, and with the internet, suddenly the players were younger, they were better educated, and they were just sharper. And that hasn't changed. In fact, it's, you know, I mean, to me, you know, and I still play in the World Series of Poker, but I'm pretty much limiting myself now to the seniors event, because the open events are really tough.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, as you get older, the hours required, not a lot of sleep, you know, long days, you know, that takes a toll as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I don't know that I could play in the main event at this point in my life. It's such a grind. It's a grind for the young guys. So it puts guys in my age group at a huge disadvantage.
Oh, it's not so bad as long as you blow out early in the first day.
Yeah.
You were mentioning your friend who had these family issues.
Yeah.
Nathan, your main character, has a whole lot of those too. And Nathan and his wife and his 4-year-old daughter and his very imperfect father there's a whole lot of family stuff going on. I've had my own family issues, not quite the same as what you described, but I recognize these things. It's like it made me feel uncomfortable because some of the discussions were so close to home. And the same is true as when we talk in a few weeks about your book, Vig, where in that book the problems you're having with Anna are sort of uncomfortable, but part of the world that gamblers live in. I thought that was much truer to life than most gambling books. In most books, that kind of thing is glossed over. But here you make us look at it front and center.
Well, I also think, you know, that's what good art does, right, is find those moments of truth that we respond to, you know, and that, I mean, it's very clear you were a very good writer because both of us were affected by your books.
Thanks. I mean, you know, with this novel, I really wanted to explore the effect that family has on a gambler. I don't think I've in all the poker novels that I've read, I don't think there's any that has explored what married life is like for a gambler and for the gambler's family. And so that was really at the heart of what inspired me to write this book and what I was interested in exploring.
Yeah, it's something we talk about often on this show, because you're right. It's and I've said many times on the show that one of the reasons I married my wife is she understood from the beginning that this was a job, and it was really, really rare for any woman I met to get it, but she just did from the beginning. So,
yeah, I mean, I think it's certainly, you know, in my own life, with my wife, I made it very clear when we first started dating who I was and what my interests were, and the fact that that was a part of me she was going to have to accept if she wanted to have a relationship. And she did. You know, she went into it with her eyes open. So that's never been an issue with us. But I will say that, you know, when we were first together, when I was, and I've been with my wife for 20 years now, but when we were first together, you know, I would tell her about what was happening at the club and, you know, about my wins and losses. And I could see that it was difficult for her to process that because she didn't have, though she understood that was part of who I was, she didn't understand the kind of swings that happen. And so I made the decision at a certain point that our relationship would be, would go a lot more smoothly if I didn't, share with her the ups and downs. You know, I think as I even write in the book, it's enough to have one person on the roller coaster.
Yeah. And, or to just share with them, like at the end of the year, you know, this is how,
exactly.
this is how I did for the year.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, you know, I've always kept careful records. And so that has been, one aspect that has always been a net positive in terms of in God, I mean, I've been playing poker for 40 years now. I think I've had one losing year in 40 years. So it's, you know, it's always been a positive in my life, at least on the level of, at least on the monetary level. You know, I can, there are definitely ways in which, and, you know, I mean, one thing is, it's been interesting during COVID because I haven't been playing in the live games. I've been playing a little bit online in some online home games. But I'm beginning to reexamine for myself whether, and with my, you know, remaining time on Earth limited, how much of that time I actually want to spend playing poker at this point.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, so it's a priority thing.
And our priority is to have a brief commercial break at this point. We're going to return to Peter Olson, and we're going to be asking him about the mob scenes in his book in a few moments. South Point is more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. This is more than anyone else has. In September, the promotion is the $500,000 guaranteed money madness, where you have two casino-wide progressives running at all times. The major one must hit between $10,000 and $25,000, where all players playing, when it goes off, receive $25 in free play. To be eligible for that $25, you must have played any machine with your card in it at least $1 in the previous minute. The minor jackpot must hit between $1,000 and $2,500 and is scheduled to be hit about three times a day. At predicted.org, there's a market where you can place small bets on the occurrence of various political events, mostly but not entirely in the United States. The active markets right now are related to the November 3rd election, whether it's the presidency itself or senators, representatives in all the districts, all the states. So there's a large number of markets there. If you bet on who's going to win Montana for the presidency, and it's something like 94 cents out of a dollar for Trump, even if you're right, you're not going to make any money because there's a house edge that they take out of that. So that would be a bet you could win and lose money. So to have any shot at making money, you need to, you could certainly bet the other side, but that's a real long shot of coming in. So you need to consider the house edge when you make your bets. The Our listeners get a one-time offer of deposit match up to $20 at predictit.org/promo/edge. You must play the money through once and cannot withdraw it for 30 days. VideoPoker.com is the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get correction on most of the games. The game of the week is Ultimate X. This game requires a bet of 10 coins per line, and every time you get paid on a line, you get a multiplier on the same line for the next hand. The top multiplier is 12x. The strategy for Ultimate X is considerably different than regular video poker. VideoPoker.com has an additional product called the Pro Trainer for a monthly fee, which covers every possible Ultimate X pay schedule and the 3-play or 5-play version. So if you find one that you like, you can practice it and get correction until you get as good as you want. All right, we're back talking to Peter Olson about his book, The Only Way to Play It. Part of your story has to do with the Russian mob. How much of that was based on fact and how much was made up? And would the Russian mob in 2020 be comparable to the way it was 8-10 years earlier when it was set?
Well, I would say that almost all of the Russian mob part, all the stuff that takes place in Brighton Beach in the book, is invented. I have played in various underground games with guys of Russian descent, some of whom I suspect are mob, and some of whom I know are mob, and so I've been around those guys. I've seen them, but in all my playing time, I never went out to Brighton Beach. I never played in any games there. So that part is all invented. But I did do a bunch of research, and I actually traveled out to Brighton Beach so that I could get a physical sense of the place. And there's a scene set at this club called the Club Cafe called the Tatiana, and I did visit that place. And you know, I do like to do research for my fiction, because I do want things to feel authentic and to be accurate. But at the same time, the club that they play in there is invented. The name is invented. It was fun to write. Because there were, you know, there were really no limits except my imagination.
What about the way they got Nathan on the hook? Because that also rang true to me, where they wanted to get their hooks into a winning player and keep him on the hook. Have you run across that anywhere?
I have, not coincidentally, it was a game run by a guy whose name was Russian Will. I played in that game, a year and a half. And I was a winning player in that game, but I started to hear that there was funny business going on there. And then I ran into a guy who was on the hook in the same way that Nathan gets entrapped in the book. So that was the inspiration for that. There was definitely a reality to that.
Now, Nathan in your book doesn't seem to experience average luck. This is either all good or all bad. And my experience with gambling is with smaller swings. and more long-term failure, at least in backgammon, or more long-term success in video poker. Do you see Nathan's ups and downs as typical of the players in New York, or did you make them more severe so the story could move along?
Well, you know, I personally have had I have had downswings that have lasted as long as 6 months. So I know that, swings like that do happen. And there's nothing worse than being on a downswing like that. You know, as Daniel Negreanu, once said during a downswing, he said, you know, do I even know how to play this game? You really do start to question yourself. And of course it does compound, so that when you're on a downswing, your level of play deteriorates. And, you know, in the same way that when you're on an upswing, when you're running good, you're playing better. You're more attuned and focused. But for the purposes of this novel, I've always loved stories where someone starts trying to dig themselves out of a hole, and the more that they dig, the deeper in they get, and things just keep going wrong, and it's sort of delicious and exquisite agony, and I wanted to make to have the reader experience that through Nate. So every time it looks like he's pulled himself out, something goes wrong, not necessarily related to poker, but just other kinds of bad luck. And that, you know, that also relates to the epigraph of the book, the Cormac McCarthy, where he says, you know, you never know what worse luck your bad luck has saved you from. That's a rough paraphrase of it. That is true. So, you know, when the worst luck is when the guy gets shot in the poker club. I mean, that's the worst luck you can have. And any other kind of bad luck you might have pales by comparison.
Well, maybe shot and paralyzed might be worse than shot and killed.
That would be bad. That might be worse. Yeah.
The only way to play it. How did you pick that particular title?
Oh man, you know, the titles are really hard. And this book went through many, many titles while I was working on it. At one point, my agent sent it out, and it did not have the title, The Only Way to Play It. It was called, The Lucky and the Good. I never was thoroughly happy with that title, even though I liked the idea of it. That came from the phrase, you're either lucky or you're good. I sort of like, and it's sometimes it's hard to know which is which. So I like that idea, but finally I just didn't like it as a title. And then The Only Way to Play It, it's funny. I don't remember. It was just like one day I was thinking about how there are so many different ways to play a hand. So the idea of The Only Way to Play It was almost ironic because in the end, that is one of the themes of the book is, you know, if you had it to do over again, would you do it the same way? And that's the kind of question that poker players always ask. You know, will I play this? How would I play this hand if I had it to do over again? And so I like it as a title. It's, you know, it's sort of tinged with a faint irony.
You know, we sort of connected to you through Deke Castleman, who we have in common. He's edited all of our books on this show. And I'm just curious how you ended up with Deke, how that connection happened.
So in my search for a publisher for this book, which proved to be much more difficult than I ever anticipated, all of my other books were published by mainstream publishers. And I, you know, the landscape in publishing has changed radically. And so I really had a hard time finding a publisher for this book. And at one point I did send the book to Huntington Press. And Deke read it and loved it, loved the book, and was very supportive of it. But, you know, what was going on there seemed like it was going to take too long to get the book to publication. And I finally just decided that I was going to start a small press myself, which is what I've done. I'm publishing 4 books this year. And I'm going to be publishing, many more in the future. And,
oh, wow.
And it's called Arbitrary Press. And, I did an Indiegogo campaign to fund it, got a lot of support, and, so far so good.
So you're publishing other people. You're not going to try to write 4 books a year or whatever.
Yeah. No, I'm publishing other people. So one of the things that I've been doing over the years is, in addition to my writing, I also am an editor, and I have shepherded a number of books to publication, and quite successfully, and that's been satisfying in a way that. And it's satisfying in a different way than writing. It's sort of writing is like being the mama where you give birth yourself, and being an editor is more like, you know, being the dad and sort of watching this thing birth. Anyway, over the course of it, I've formed relationships with a lot of writers who now are asking me, hey, can I publish my book with you? So if it's a book I like, then I'm going to publish it.
That's great.
Yeah.
Now, in this book, there's a lot of strife between Nathan and his wife at various points. And so when you get your head wrapped up in that strife, did you find that affected your own family life because your head was wrapped up in this novel? On did that make you harder to live with? Would your wife say that made you harder to live with?
Oh man, I mean, I think, you know, my wife would say almost anything that I do that I have to wrestle with makes it harder for her to live with me. But she's pretty indulgent. I mean, like I said, we've been together for 20 years now, so she's seen the best of me and the worst of me, and she's still here.
No accounting for taste sometimes.
Yeah, I know. It says a lot.
Now, I enjoyed this book. There's a whole lot of the twists and turns in it that we haven't shared for spoiler alert reasons. I enjoyed it. I think most of the listeners to the show will enjoy it. Now, this podcast is going to air on September 10th, although many of our listeners will listen to it after that. Is the book available now, and where can you get it?
So the book is now available for pre-order. The actual publication date is September 15th. And it's going to be available on in a number of forms. So it's going to be Kindle, paperback, hardcover, and audiobook. And I'm really excited about it in all those different forms, because people consume books now in so many different ways. And I know some people, you know, only listen to books now. And so I definitely wanted to have to let them have that option. And I don't read the book myself. I actually auditioned 55 people. And,
wow.
Yeah. And hired a guy who's amazing. You know, I didn't realize until I listened to him do it that there were so many different accents in the book. And this guy is a great actor and does all these different accents. And it in a way, it was like listening to the movie version of my book. It was a lot of fun for me. So yes, the book is available, now for pre-order and will be mailed out or sent out, on September 15th.
The last thing I want to talk to you about is you were on the show in terms of reference, years ago when we did an interview with Nolan Dalla on the book about Stewie Younger.
One of a kind.
One of a kind. And so at that point, you were just a name. And do you have any remembrances of that book that you'd like to share with us?
Well, I mean, that book is, you know, it's an evergreen. It's now, it came out, close to 15 years ago, maybe 15 years ago. And you know, it's still selling. It's a great story. Stewie was an incredible, unforgettable character. And you know, as a result of working on that book with Nolan, he and I have become great friends. So that book has been a good experience for me in every way imaginable. So many good things for me have come out of that book.
Yeah, definitely. For any of our listeners who haven't read that, it's a really good book.
So we're going to talk to you in the relative near future about your new old book, Vig, which is, it's a 25-year-old book that you're republishing also on September 15th. I'm looking forward to that. It's both Richard and I have finished that book and have enjoyed it, and we're going to highly recommend it. So thank you, Peter.
Thank you. It's a lot of fun.
At the end of our show, we typically go into a recommended section. So where the co-hosts, or at least one of the co-hosts, comes up with something they'd like to tell the listeners about. So, Richard, what do you got?
My recommended this week is an app called Hotels Tonight. I've been talking, a lot of the blackjack players are getting back out on the road, even with the COVID thing. And Hotels Tonight is an app that gives you the price of a hotel room for tonight. So hotels have these leftover inventory that they want to get rid of. They put it on this app at much cheaper prices than you can find on any other website. And so if you are somebody who's out on the road going from the casino to casino, it's a free app. Highly recommend it. It'll save you money. Hotels Tonight, it's called.
Very good. And to make up for me not having a recommended this week, let me give you Peter Olson. Peter, do you have a recommended?
I do. I actually watched a documentary that just became available on Apple TV. It's directed and written by a friend of mine, a guy named David Greenwald, who actually was at one point going to make the movie version of my book about sports gambling. Unfortunately, that never happened, but he has made this movie called The Bleck Effect. That's BLECH. And it's about a guy named Bleck, who made, at one point was listed in Forbes 400. He was worth $300 million. And he started all these biotech companies and made a fortune doing it, and then gambled it all away on the stock market, and also got charged with fraud and various things. And so this documentary is about the days leading up to him going off to prison, and whether or not he will win this case, and whether or not this new company that he started that has a potential cure for Alzheimer's will make him $100 million as he expects or not. And it's a very compelling film. His family he has a son who may or may not have autism or brain damage. It's hard to tell. And he's a teenage son, and this guy, Bleck, suffers from bipolar disorder, and that is really what leads him to this kind of grim fate. And any gambler, can relate to it. And I just found it to be a very compelling film, so I recommend it highly.
We'll put a link to that in the show notes.
Yeah.
That sounds very interesting and very horrible.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's kind of depressing, but I like that kind of thing.
Thank you very much, Peter.
Thank you, guys.
We're going to be talking to you soon.
Okay.
Thank you, Richard. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.